Latido de lunes a jueves. You
the Safari Park. You're killing me, Larry.
Larry, fucking Larry.
Larry from That Larry Show.
For men with balls.
Take off your pants.
Larry, get into bed now.
Larry.
Larry. Larry.
If I sound a bit different than usual, well, it's still me. Only the recording situation has changed. If I sound fatigued, it's because I am. I have filled 4 dumpsters with crap, packed a 16x8x8 foot shipping container with slightly less crappy crap in cardboard boxes, all padded, sealed, and meticulously labeled. I'm coming to you from the same place as usual. The Take No Shit Dojo, located at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment, which, since this show began, has been the fabulous San Fernando Valley. Well, formerly fabulous, that is. As recently as 3 or 4 years ago, if someone said they were leaving SoCal, the predictable response from people was, "Have you lost your mind?" Now, responses vary from, "I'm so jealous," to, "Take me with you." The recording equipment I'm using is portable gear. The good stuff has been broken down and is packed into that container, awaiting transport. This room is empty. Some reverb, huh? There's nothing in here but me to absorb the sound. The past few months have been, different. I won't say difficult. Difficult is digging a ditch in 100-degree heat. Difficult is divorce. Difficult is dialysis. Selling my home and getting ready to flee L.A. has been, in the grand scheme of things, a minor hassle. Dealing with realtors and potential homebuyers traipsing through your inner sanctum, that shit's annoying, but it had to be done. The toughest part has been something I did not anticipate. Something I've delved into in several episodes, most recently, number 413, Prom Night Nostalgia, that's in the May 2023 tab at thatlarryshow.com. In that episode, I recounted driving my daughter to her high school prom, as well as memories of my own prom. While combing through old pictures, I came across some of that very night and my date, Virginia. I would post them on the show page, but they're already out in that damn container. But she was every bit as stunning as I recalled. I'm not a hoarder, but I do hang on to things that have meaning to me, like photographs. I got a couple footlockers full of them, and sorting through those became...
Larry Blydner, this is your life.
Seeing myself as an infant... Mom and Dad bringing me home from the hospital on a gray autumn day in New York. And all those other milestone events that made Mom reach for the Instamatic and pop off a few frames. First Holy Communion, graduation, some birthdays, fishing, always fishing. From a 2-year-old reeling in a soggy newspaper in a mud puddle to a little snapper blues on Shark River, New Jersey with Dad and my brother to a young man me. Still with Dad and brother, headed out in a party boat for bigger game. Next, a slightly less young man hauling in barracuda off the coast of Mexico. Then, fishing with my wife, and finally, with my teenaged daughters. A visual time capsule that put a lump in my throat. In just a few weeks, I'll be helping my younger girl move into a dorm as a freshman, and my older girl gets settled in at grad school. How did this happen? Time is insidious, relentless, and sneaky. Family photographs are peculiar items. I have tens of thousands, and I'll be damned if I know why. Because the only time I've ever looked at them is when I moved, and I didn't do that very often. The thousands of digital images buried on various drives, well, those will likely never be seen. You find yourself in some peak moment of life, watching your kids being born, or seeing them tear into Christmas gifts, or riding a pony, or standing at the rim of the Grand Canyon, whatever, and it's so wonderful you feel compelled to grab a camera and capture it, but you can't, any more than a picture can capture the taste and smell of a porterhouse steak. Lately, I've cut way, way back on family pictures. Taking them just distract you from fully enjoying the moment. As powerful as the photographs are, there are other mementos that pack a more potent wallop. Handwritten letters. Not a greeting card. Those are for when you care enough to send the very least. Prefab sentiment. Fill in the blank. Salutation, dear so-and-so, followed by Hallmark's all-purpose message for birthday, wedding, condolence, followed by your signature. The communication equivalent of a microwave dinner. Now, a short note inside a greeting card elevates it from perfunctory to personal, but an actual letter covering an entire page or more, that says something. I found a lot of those. Every one of them was powerful, if not for the content, then merely by the intention and effort that somebody took the time to stay in one place and put down their thoughts to me, and then address it and stamp it and mail it. Energy, thought, originality, authenticity. You may have noticed my account was knocked off Twitter. I had 1,600 or 1,700 followers, I think. I really loathe Twitter. Even post-Musk purchase, it's infested with commie filth. People have asked me what I did that angered the Twitch trust and safety crew. Well, they didn't say exactly what. Might have been my relentless bashing of California's silver spoon shitbag governor, Gavin Newsom. What a punk he is. Or maybe it was when I said that the globalist architects of lockdowns and vax mandates should be hung from lampposts, monitored by live streaming webcams so we can watch the crows peck out their lifeless eyeballs. And then I attached an image of Mussolini and his cohorts hanging from their feet in the town square. But really, that was not a threat. No one was named. It was just a suggestion. I'll be formulating a new Twitter identity for the show, and I'll let you know when I do. And now here we are, on the dawn of another summer. Summer, the indisputable king of the seasons. The one much of the world waits for, when we trade boots and coats for flip-flops and t-shirts, huh? The drudgery of snow shoveling for the ease of sunbathing. I've done a number of shows celebrating the wonders of summer, especially in the place I spent a lot of my youth, the New Jersey Shore. It truly was a magical place. Over the years, I hit every town from Asbury Park to Cape May. Each had a distinct flavor and something to offer, but the big draw, of course, was the mighty Atlantic. Summers on the Jersey Shore beat the ass off of the Pacific Coast. There was no comparison. The beaches were cleaner, the sand was finer, there were almost no rocks on which to smash your face when body surfing, or kelp beds to drown you. And the girls were spectacular. Sorry, beach boys. The Jersey girls were every bit as beautiful, and they had that East Coast edge of wit and sarcasm that's virtually non-existent west of the Mississippi. So I'm going to now regale you with a couple of tales from the Jersey Shore. One is a fish story. The other, a brush with a maniac that my friends and I brought upon ourselves. So sitting to my left was this grizzled old guy with a tackle box the size of a footlocker. I always wondered about those guys. They open the thing up and inside is every piece of fishing gear ever made. This guy pulls from it an industrial, hospital-sized brown glass bottle of Anacin. The thing looked ancient, Only shreds of the label remained. I felt bad for the guy. He must get a fuck ton of headaches. Then he uncaps it, puts it to his lips, and takes a long slug. As far as I know, they never made liquid anison. Odd way to store your booze, too, and it wasn't for stealth purposes. Nobody gave a shit when anyone was drinking. After he downed the booze, he chuckled to himself some private joke. He sounded like Aqualung when he laughed. The old guy was just weird. More on him later. A couple of bodies down the line was another odd dude, Jack. Jack was probably in his mid-40s, skinny, with a flannel shirt and a ruddy face. He'd been drinking since we left the dock, and he'd not brought his own. He was buying them from the boat, which they were happy to sell, and not cheaply. And Jack's pretty well loaded. And finally, when we're deep into the acid waters, the skipper cuts the engine and gives the horn a single toot. Drop your lines. There are many ways to catch bluefish. You can use a big shiny metal lure called a jig. Drop it straight down and reel it up fast. They'll snap at it on the way up. But on this day, we were drifting cut bait. Big hunks of greasy fish called mossbunker. I'm already paying out line to drift the bait, and sometimes you just have to wait until the school swoops in, and then all hell breaks loose. I look over at Jack, and he's holding one of the rods the boat's rented. They were always painted some garish color to discourage thievery, I guess. And I see Jack roll up his sleeves on his flannel shirt in prep for battling bluefish. And Jack's left arm looked like something out of a medical journal. It is literally skin and bone. Not an ounce of muscle on it from shoulder to fingertips. What's left of his hand and fingers are frozen into a permanent curl. I was immediately reminded of a terrific Stephen King short story. I think it was called The Mangler, and it was about some huge machine in an industrial laundry that was possessed by a malevolent entity, and the mangler would eat guys' arms and sometimes all of them. Jack looked like a mangler survivor. Now, I should mention something here. When bluefish bite, nobody ever says, "I got a bite." They say, "I got a hit," because that's what they do. They swim hard and crazy fast, and when they hit your line, it's hard to believe it's only a 20-pound fish. It feels like 100 pounds. And after reeling in just one, your arms will ache. The damn things have supernatural strength. And I'm wondering, how the hell is this essentially one-armed, drunken guy going to reel in one of these fish? How can he possibly even hang on to the rod if he gets a hit? Oh, my reverie was broken by a hit of my own. But it was an oddball. Usually when a school of blues streaks by, several guys get hits simultaneously. And this hit was not as hard as a bluefish. Well, no matter. I'm cranking away, and suddenly my line feels slack, and I think, shit, I lost him. So I continue to reel, but I can still feel more weight on the line than just the bait. Finally, I get it alongside and see the head, and only the head, of a striped bass. When I hooked him, he was whole, but in transit something, one or more blues or maybe a shark, took his body. That's part of the great fun of saltwater fishing. You just never know what fuckery will occur. I pull up the head, and behind me I hear, he's swilling liquid anison again, and is clearly amused by my mutilated catch. I unhook the head and bait up with a fresh chunk of bunker and start drifting. But suddenly, guys are yelling, "Fish on!" And zip, zip, lines are singing as they tighten up, and people are walking fish all over the boat, trying not to let the hooked fishes weave through lines and cause a snarl. I reel in, not wanting to get ensnared in the mayhem. I look over at Jack. Incredibly, He's cradling the rod in his frozen, bony hand as he chugs a fresh beer with his good hand. Suddenly, Jack's line goes taut, and the rod shoots through his frozen hand and skips across the water surface for a few yards before heading for Davy Jones' locker. After a few minutes, the hubbub dies down. A bunch of guys have bagged their fish, and there's a lull in the action. And the mate walks by, and Jack says,
"Excuse me, I need another beer and another fishing rod."
And the mate says, "Another rod? What's wrong with the one you rented?"
"It's gone."
"Gone where?" And Jack points over the side with his skeletal arm. The mate notices his arm for the first time. His eyes bulge, and he goes, "Holy shit, how the hell are you going to fish with that?"
I can manage.
And now, the skipper is above on the bridge. He's been eavesdropping and looks down at Jack and says, "No more beer for you, buddy. And the only thing you need to manage is coming up with $150 for the rod you lost." And Jack looks insulted.
$150? That was a used rod.
And the skipper says, "Not as used as that arm of yours." I'm trying hard not to belly laugh. Same as my dad and brother. We made several more stops, caught a bunch more bluefish. Then, at the last stop, the skipper gave a double toot. Time to go home. That's when guys bring their catch to the stern for two things. Weigh in for the pool, and to have them filleted. It's one of the best feelings in the world to ride on a boat headed for shore as you watch somebody cut your fish into what would be many fantastic meals. When you get within a few miles of shore, the gulls fly out to greet the boat. They know they can get their belly full of whatever they want, fish guts thrown over the side as well as unused bait. If you hold out a good-sized chunk of fish, they'll fly down and snatch it right out of your hand, even as that boat is banging along into a headwind at a good clip. They have big gullets and swallow enormous hunks of fish whole. Sometimes a marauder will fly in and snatch it from another bird. They'll have fights in midair over a morsel. I sat down to have a beer and watch the gulls wheeling. The Anison-drinking geezer had his mammoth tackle box open and was laughing to himself as usual. His fingers were very busy. I'm wondering what the hell he's doing. He's got about 18 inches of line and a couple of hunks of bunker, and he's baiting a hook. I figure he must have been slugging Wild Turkey 101, and he's so hammered he doesn't realize that fishing is over. He looks up and smiles at me. Many teeth were missing. Then he starts twirling the baited hook like a keychain and throws it into the air. That's when I realize what the sick fuck was doing. He had a baited hook on each end of the line. And now one gull swoops down and gobbles the bait, and the other one gets the other hook, and they fly in tandem for about 3 seconds, and one peels off, and you see its gullet and tongue come out of its beak, and he tumbles downward to drown, and the other one flies off with a hook in his belly and a length of line with the first gull's guts dangling from it. The geezer can't stop laughing, and he calls out,
"You greedy motherfuckers!"
Then he went back to his Anison bottle. I went inside to take a leak and ponder what a cruel, sick world it could be and how filled it is with batshit crazy assholes. The traffic is bumper to bumper and rubber banding due to the traffic lights. It would crawl for a while, the light would change. You could attain maybe 20 miles an hour and then have to throw out the anchor again as the light up ahead turned red. Suddenly, Kevin exclaims,
"Look at that fucking guy."
And up ahead on the right is a jogger, but no ordinary jogger. He wore no shorts and Nikes, no. This guy looked as if he had popped out of some time machine from ancient Rome. No, that's not quite accurate because Romans did not have access to steroids. The guy was the size of a parade float, Muscles on top of muscles in that bloated fake physique that only chemistry can provide. And he's actually wearing some kind of gladiator loincloth and espadrilles with the laces snaking right up his massively cut calves. And he's got that Hercules beard, you know, the kind that skirts the jawline and is trimmed so precisely it looks like it was applied with an ink marker. He looks like the star of all those old Gladiator and Hercules movies from the 50s, that Steve Reeves guy, except he's twice the size of Steve. And so the light changes, and we start to move at a decent clip, and as we roll by this Romanesque bodybuilder parade float of a man, we all start to laugh because his appearance is really comical. And Kevin shouts at him, "Hey, Hercules!" And I look behind and I see the guy grinning. That's probably the nicest compliment he's ever been paid. He's spent years in the gym and thousands on Dianabol, and at last somebody has called him the name of the mythological figure he has worked so hard to emulate. The guy is beaming. He gives us a nod and a little wave. But this is Kevin, and I know there's another shoe to drop. No, not a shoe, more like a verbal daisy cutter. And I hear Kevin inhale for the delivery. "Nice skirt, girly man." The grin slides off Herc's face. His eyes bulge. Kevin's comment hit him like a harpoon, right in the ego. Hercules shouts, "You motherfucking punks!" And he starts to sprint, just as the traffic backs down. I half expect the asphalt to pucker with every footfall from this freak. I hear Jimmy mutter Jesus Christ because this guy looks like he could tear the door off the car with a pinky. And he's gaining on us and gaining on us. And I say lock the doors and roll up the windows, which is absolutely futile. We feel like we're in one of those jeeps in Jurassic Park with T-Rex chasing us. And now this fucking crazy maniac is about 10 yards off our tail and closing fast. He's in the middle of the lane behind us, and he lunges with his fist outstretched to pound the rear deck. He'll probably flip the Pontiac like a tiddlywink. At that instant, traffic moves forward, and Jimmy hits the gas hard enough to chirp the tires. Hercules' fist missed the trunk lid and lands on the rear bumper. And he loses his balance and sprawls face first on the roadbed. And Kevin's head pops out the rear window once again.
"Hey, trade those sandals for sneakers."
Herc is back on his feet with steam shooting from both ears. We can hear him growl some threat as he again takes off after us. Now we cannot stop laughing. Herc is again pounding the asphalt, and now there's a trickle of blood running down both his shins where he fell trying to punch the Pontiac. We're cruising along at a pretty good clip, maybe 25 miles an hour, and have opened a comfortable lead between us and the loincloth psychotic. And then traffic starts to slow again. But not Herc. He must be putting in some road work along with the bench presses, and goddamn if he isn't gaining on us. And now his face is purple with rage. The guy has triple homicide on his mind. Our speed slows to 15, 10, 5 miles an hour. Behind us, Herc clocks along. He's covered in sweat. His massive chest is heaving. The cords in his neck stand out like rope. His eyes are ablaze with murderous fury. Suddenly, Jimmy pulls a lug wrench from under the seat and hands it to me, saying he'll probably attack on your side first, and I'm thinking, I don't need a lug wrench. I need an elephant gun. Now, Herc is maybe 15 feet off the bumper. Should I maybe just open the door and wail on him with a wrench? We're dead stopped. It's on. I say a silent prayer. I got the wrench in a death grip, ready to bury it in Herc's skull. Probably not a vital area, but suddenly, the car lurches forward again as traffic begins to move. We gasp. Jimmy tells Kevin to shut the fuck up. Too late. Kevin's head is out the rear window once again.
"Hey, Herc, you know your girly legs are bleeding?"
We move ahead, but finally, Herc is out of gas. He doubles over and pukes on the shoulder. Guys who are 5'10 and weigh over 300 are just not built for distance. It was over. I hope you enjoyed those stories. I'm sorry this episode is a day or two late, but things have been really hectic recently, and I do this solamente. No producers, no engineers, just me. Next week, I'll be on the road. I might record part of the show right in the car or wherever we heave to overnight. It might be an assemblage of mini-sodes, but I'm looking forward to you riding shotgun with me as I cross the continent once again. If you want to write, and by all means do, it's thatlarryshow@gmail.com. If you want to help support the show, and please do, just click the Patreon or PayPal button. They can be found at thatlarryshow.com, along with hundreds of other episodes. Wish me luck and Godspeed. And until next Wednesday or thereabouts, from some hotel or motel somewhere between the coasts, take no shit.